This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Earlier this week, we spoke with Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin about her personal reasons for supporting some key aspects of the Affordable Care Act. President Donald Trump campaigned on repealing and replacing the ACA and has voiced strong support for the American Health Care Plan, which would weaken the ACA. Although the new bill continues to make its way through the House, it remains intensely controversial among both Democrats and Republicans.
Barbara Zabawa is following the developments closely. She's founder and leads the Wisconsin-based Center for Health and Wellness Law and a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. She's also an occasional Lake Effect contributor. Welcome back to the show.
So glad to be here, Mitch.
We're glad you're here and hope you can help us make sense of the latest in the debate over health care reform legislation. This is the bill that's now been labeled Trump Care, for lack of a better term. It passed through a House committee this week. It's on its way to the House floor. It might be changed a little bit. Let me just get your assessment of what you see that bill doing in the continuum of care, if you will.
Right. Well, it was two different committees that proposed different changes to the Affordable Care Act. One of the committees, the House Ways and Means Committee, proposed changes that really does away with all the taxes and the subsidies of the Affordable Care Act. The employer mandate goes away. The individual mandate goes away. The other committee, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, passed legislation that would really make some significant changes to Medicaid, making it into a block grant program, putting caps on spending, and then also proposes some other changes to the Affordable Care Act, more substantive changes. It takes out money for the Public Health Prevention Trust Fund. And one of the biggest changes is instead of having an individual mandate, it puts in place a health insurance continuation provision whereby to incentivize people more with a carrot that if to keep insurance or buy insurance, especially for the younger, healthier population, you would get a 30% reduction on your premium if you bought insurance and maintained continuous coverage. Rather than waiting until the last minute when you need it, you might have to pay 30% more of a penalty, and you might have a waiting period for some pre-existing conditions. So that's the mechanism that they've put in place to kind of replace the individual mandate to try to get more younger, healthier people into the risk pool.
So the idea is that they're going to create incentives for them to be a part of it but not require it.
Yes. Right.
The Congressional Budget Office came out with its report on what the impact of the bill as it stands today. And we should say it could still undergo some significant changes. In fact, we hear it might be likely to undergo significant changes before it comes to a full House vote. And who knows when we get to the Senate. The Congressional Budget Office, there two things came out of it. The number of people with insurance would change and the amount of money the government might save would change.
Right. So the number of people who would lose coverage has been estimated about 24 million.
That's over 10 years, correct?
Yes, over 10 years. I think 14 million immediately would lose coverage. And then the Congressional Budget Office states that the legislation would reduce federal deficits by $337 billion over the next 10 years.
So let's talk about that $337 billion over 10 years, because that's a lot of money. Is there something in that savings that would then be directed back into investing in the healthcare system to potentially offset some of the coverage issues?
Well, one of the things that the House American Health Care Act, or Trump Care as you've labeled it, puts in place is a patient and state stability fund, which would provide funding to the states to help offset some of these losses that might occur in coverage, to help boost state insurance markets, individual markets in particular. And so I would assume that a lot of that money would be poured into this patient and state stability fund. Ultimately, what this fund does is give states flexibility to figure out how they can best cover the residents of their state.
And there's kind of a philosophical question at the heart of that, right? That you know, whether it should be the federal government, whether it should be the states or the private insurance or private individuals who are best able to decide who ought to be covered.
Right. Well, and clearly the position of the current administration is that these decisions are best left up to the states and not the federal government. I mean, I think that's their position across many issues, not just health care. So it's clearly a federalism bent to this type of approach.
Well, and maybe this is an unfair question, which I am sure you're excited to hear. But as you look at where the country was in terms of covering people and granting access to or enabling access to health care, when you look at where we were before Obamacare or the ACA passed, you know, let's turn back to 2006 or 2007 and where the current bill would put us, would it still be further along than we were 8 or 9 years ago?
You know, that really depends on some of the other provisions that are being tossed around Congress as far as, you know, they're talking about repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act in three different phases. This bill that we've been talking about is phase one. Phase two, I'm not quite sure what will constitute that, but probably less of a budgetary, less budgetary related provisions. And then phase three, another set of or round of proposals to revamp the healthcare system. And within that, there might be some provisions about selling insurance across state lines, maybe establishing high-risk pools in states or helping states establish high-risk pools. And so, you know, depending on what's in those packages, those phase two and phase three, it's hard to tell if we're going to be going back to where we were before the Affordable Care Act or if we will have made some progress. I mean, certainly within the healthcare industry, there is a lot of support for a lot of the initiatives that the Affordable Care Act has really spearheaded, things like value-based care, accountable care organizations, you know, paying for value rather than volume. And those are initiatives that really aren't tied to any federal budgets. So, and they seem to have bipartisan support, but it's hard to tell at this time, you know, what the full picture will look like once it's all been hashed out.
Well, and to follow the debate in the committee rooms and soon on the House and Senate floors, potentially, it's hard to get around the idea that really what's being debated here is how we treat healthcare in this country, right? Privilege, something else?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that really is the heart of, in my mind, that's the heart of the matter. You know, we pay taxes to support public goods, things like national parks, things like public safety, things like infrastructure that we as individuals may never use. We may never visit all the national parks or any national parks, but yet we contribute to that as a country because we've collectively believed that those are things that people have a right to do. Whether they choose to do it or not is another thing, but we all contribute. Healthcare is being it's being treated differently than that. There seems to be still a debate about whether everyone is entitled to health care, health coverage. And those can be two separate things, but they really are linked together. And so that's why you hear a lot of the discussions. When I hear a lot of the discussions questioning, well, why should I have to pay for maternity coverage if I never use it? Those same types of questions could be posed in the context of, you know, public safety or national parks. Why should I have to pay for a national park if I've never visited it or I never intend to visit it? But yet we don't ask those questions. But in healthcare, we are asking those questions. And so as long as those questions continue to be asked, and then the debate about whether everyone, regardless of income, regardless of age, gender, is entitled to health care is going to continue to be up for debate.
Well, And so the ACA repeal and replace legislation has gotten a lot of the headlines. You would also point us to another bill that's currently up for debate or has legislation that's been introduced. What is the Workplace Wellness Bill?
Yes, it's a health bill, H.R. 1313. And what it essentially does is eviscerates the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act protections for workplace wellness programs, which means that workplace wellness programs, if this bill would become law, would have the ability to ask very private questions of employees, you know, questions about your family medical history, questions about your genetic information, other questions regarding your health status, and be able to penalize you if you don't answer those questions. And of course, from the perspective of a wellness program or an employer, that change in the law would make these programs much easier to administer. They wouldn't have to worry about a lot of the regulatory burdens that right now are enforced by the EEOC. But at the same time, employee privacy and their family member privacy, frankly, would be implicated if this bill became law.
So this might be a situation where they could ask if a family member had ever died of lung cancer, and then as a workplace require their employee to undergo smoking cessation programs, or the requirements could be based on the family medical history.
Yes. I mean, meaning they could penalize you up to 30% of the cost of your health insurance coverage, for example.
And this, we should say, has just been introduced. It is not law yet, but certainly something that that you would make the case people ought to be paying attention to.
Yes, I do believe that people should be aware of it, because it might get subsumed into a larger piece of legislation in one of those phase two or phase three proposals that comes out of Congress.
Now, and of course, the ultimate aim of corporate wellness programs is to have healthier employees who need to use their health insurance less. You know, you could hear people argue that, you know, this makes it easier for companies to help their employees be healthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am not a critic necessarily of workplace wellness and employee wellness and people trying to maximize their lives. But I also see the potential for abuse, and it would be very important that some protections remain in place or get put into rules if this bill would become law, to make sure that people aren't feeling like their rights to privacy in the workplace is being infringed on in a burdensome way.
Never a dull moment in the wellness law business.
Never.
Well, I imagine we will see you again before too long. Barbara Zabawa, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor in the College of Health Sciences at UW-Milwaukee and founder of the Madison-based Center for Health and Wellness Law. She's also a Lake Effect contributor.